Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Offers of Relief and Mootness Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 20th, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Campbell Ewald Company v. Gomez. This case concerns a complaint by Jose Gomez that Campbell Ewald Company, a marketing consultant for the U.S. Navy, allowed a third-party vendor to send him unsolicited text messages in violation of the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. The case presents two questions for the Supreme Court. One, whether a case becomes moot when a plaintiff receives an offer of complete relief on his claim, including in a class action. And two, whether the doctrine of derivative sovereign immunity for government contractors is limited to claims arising out of property damage caused by public works projects. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit had held that Gomez's individual and class claims were not mooted and that Campbell Ewald was not entitled to derivative sovereign immunity. By a vote of 6-3, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Ninth Circuit, holding that, 1, an unaccepted settlement offer or offer of judgment does not moot a plaintiff's case, so the district court retains jurisdiction to adjudicate the plaintiff's complaint, and 2, a federal contractor is not entitled to immunity from suit for its violation of the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, when it violates both federal law and the government's explicit instructions. Justice Ginsburg delivered the opinion of the court, in which Justices Kennedy, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Chief Justice Roberts filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justices Scalia and Alito joined. Justice Alito also filed a dissenting opinion. To discuss the case, we have Mark Chenoweth, who is General Counsel at Washington Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Chenoweth.
Before we jump into the facts of this case, I should note that there is a derivative sovereign immunity issue in the case. Suffice it to say that the Supreme Court held that a federal contractor is not entitled to immunity from suit for violations of the Telephone Consumer Protection Act when it violated the government's instructions and federal law. I'm not going to discuss that issue further, both for the sake of time and because it's not the issue that has garnered the interest and attention of outside organizations like Washington Legal Foundation. That said, let's begin with the key facts in the case. Respondent Jose Gomez contends that he suffered an injury when petitioner Campbell Ewald Company in 2006 arranged for a third-party vendor to send him one or more unsolicited text messages urging him to join the Navy. Gomez contends that Campbell Ewald's actions violated the TCPA, which prohibits auto-texting cell phones. The TCPA includes a private right of action. Individuals injured by violations of the TCPA may seek to enjoin the violations and to recover the greater of actual damages or $500 per violation, $1,500 if the court determines that the defendant willfully or knowingly violated the statute. In addition to seeking an award of damages for himself, Gomez sought to represent a class consisting of thousands of other individuals who allegedly received unsolicited Navy recruitment text messages at the behest of Campbell Ewald. The complaint also sought an injunction requiring Campbell Ewald to cease all wireless spam activities and an award of reasonable attorney's fees and costs. However, before Gomez even filed a motion for class certification, Campbell Ewald offered to pay him $1,503 for the one Navy recruitment text message he claimed to have received and an additional $1,503 for any other similar text message, the larger amount presumably in recognition of the fact that the complaint alleged that Campbell Ewald acted willfully and knowingly, and Campbell Ewald had to accede to treble damages to remove all adverseness. Campbell Ewald also offered to pay all reasonable costs and to stipulate to an injunction prohibiting the company from engaging in the alleged wrongs. The company did not, however, admit liability or offer to pay attorney's fees. Campbell Ewald's January 11, 2010 offer to provide Gomez with all the relief he requested took two forms. First, the company filed a notice of offer of judgment with the district court pursuant to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 68. This was the Rule 68 offer. Second, the company directed a separate settlement offer to counsel for Gomez. After Gomez refused to accept the proffered cash, Campbell Ewald moved to dismiss the complaint, arguing that its offer of complete relief meant that the lawsuit no longer presented an Article III case or controversy, and thus that the district court lacked jurisdiction to issue a ruling on the merits of Gomez's claim. The district court recognized that Campbell Ewald had offered complete relief to Gomez. It nonetheless denied the motion and granted Gomez's motion to strike the Rule 68 offer. The Ninth Circuit considered and rejected Campbell Ewald's contention on appeal that his offer of complete relief to Gomez rendered his claims moot and deprived the federal courts of jurisdiction to address the merits. The appeals court held that the Rule 68 offer did not moot his individual claims because Gomez had rejected that offer, and, quote, an unaccepted Rule 68 offer that would fully satisfy a plaintiff's claim is insufficient to render the claim moot, unquote, under the Ninth Circuit's 2013 precedent in Diaz v. First American Homebuyers. The court did not separately discuss the freestanding settlement offer or consider whether it sufficed to moot the claim. The Ninth Circuit panel also held that Gomez's putative class claims were not moot. The court recognized that the U.S. Supreme Court recently had held in Genesis Healthcare Corp. v. Simchick that when a plaintiff's individual claim becomes moot and no other plaintiffs have been added to his lawsuit, Article III's case or controversy requirement requires dismissal of the suit, notwithstanding his claimed right to represent similarly situated individuals. It further conceded that Genesis undermined some of this reasoning employed by Diaz and other Ninth Circuit precedents on which the Ninth Circuit relied. But the appeals court nonetheless concluded that because Genesis was not, quote, clearly irreconcilable with the Ninth Circuit precedent, quote, this panel remains bound by circuit precedent and Campbell Ewald's mootness arguments with respect to the putative class claims must be rejected, end quote. Let's now turn briefly to the core arguments of each party before the U.S. Supreme Court. Petitioner Campbell Ewald Company contends that Article III of the U.S. Constitution requires a case or controversy in order for federal courts to have jurisdiction to hear a case. It said that, first, Gomez's individual claim was mooted by the offer of complete relief, and that once a district court determines that an offer actually is for complete relief, that should end the case. Second, it said that no Article III case exists because there's no adverseness, so no jurisdiction exists to hear the merits. Third, it said that the settlement offer here was a complete offer of relief that ended the controversy. Fourth, it said that refusing to accept a settlement offer does not keep a controversy alive, that the injury then becomes traceable to the refusal to settle and not to the original alleged harm. And last, it said that putative class claims are moot in the absence of a certified class. Now let's quickly run through the core arguments of respondent Jose Gomez. He said first that when you're talking about past injury, as we are in this case, that injury provides jurisdiction as long as it is traceable to the defendant and the requested judicial relief would redress the injury. Second, he said the offer of complete relief did not include the requested attorney's fees, and it doesn't matter, he contends, that the statute does not provide for attorney's fees, that still provides adverseness. Third, he said the offer of complete relief did not include class certification, which would provide an incentive fee to Gomez, as well as help reduce his attorney's fees by allowing them to be split with other plaintiffs. Fourth, even if the offer of relief really was complete, it can't moot the case, and at most it might justify a forced entry of judgment. And last, Gomez contended that the plaintiff has a right to an enforceable court judgment, though Justice Alito points out that receiving the actual money should be superior to such a judgment. He said that at oral argument. Well, as it turned out, the respondent had the better of the argument. Despite some sense at oral argument that there was a consensus for ordering an entry of forced judgment or something like that in this case, that did not happen. Instead, Justice Ginsburg authored the 5-1-3 majority opinion here, siding with Mr. Gomez. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Chief Justice Roberts filed a dissent joined by Justices Scalia and Alito, and Justice Alito filed a separate dissent as well. The majority opinion adopted a contractual analysis, determining that rejection of a settlement offer makes the plaintiff's ongoing interest in the lawsuit the same as if no offer were ever extended. The majority also notes that Campbell's settlement offer proposed relief for Gomez alone, did not admit liability, and never converted to actual payment. The majority uses these facts and features to distinguish Gomez's claim from 19th century railroad tax cases in which defendant railroads actually deposited the full amount due in a bank in the plaintiff's state's name. The majority also distinguishes Gomez's claim from a recent forfeiture case, Alvarez v. Smith, where all of the cars and money were either returned to the plaintiff or no longer contested. There, too, the party had actually received the disputed goods and could not maintain suit just to obtain injunctive and declaratory relief on the related legal question when the goods had already been returned. The court likewise distinguished a case, Alvarez v. Nike, involving a unilateral covenant not to sue over a trademark as providing full redress, unlike Campbell's revocable offer. Just as the Genesis court reserved the question decided in Campbell Ewald, so too the court here reserved the question, quote, whether the result would be different if a defendant deposits the full amount of the plaintiff's individual claim in an account payable to the plaintiff, and the court then enters judgment for the plaintiff in that amount, end quote. Justice Thomas's concurrence in the judgment rejects the majority's contractual approach, contending that the proper ground for deciding that an offer of complete relief does not render a claim moot is the common law history of tenders, which, quote, demonstrates that a mere offer of the sum owed is insufficient to eliminate a court's jurisdiction to decide the case to which the offer related, end quote. Thomas noted that some of the formalities attendant the common law fell away over time, such that the offer could come during and not only before the suit, and that the offer could be made even when the damages were not easily ascertainable, though the common law did always require an admission of liability. because actual payment did not accompany either the Rule 68 offer nor the freestanding settlement offer, Justice Thomas agreed that the case was not moot. He offered that the court, quote, need not decide today whether compliance with every common law formality would be necessary to end the case, end quote. The Chief Justice would have none of this. His dissent noted that Gomez wants a federal court to say he is right, but that when a court ruling is not necessary to provide relief to the plaintiff, it is necessary for the court not to rule. That is, once the court's intervention is no longer necessary, the court lacks authority to expound on the law. The Chief Justice suggests that this case is fortunately limited to its facts, and that, quote, having the firm deposit a certified check with the trial court, end quote, would suffice in the future to dispense with a case like this. The Chief Justice also takes the majority's contractual approach to task, noting that the court must decide whether a case exists and that the plaintiff's agreement is not required to moot a case. Hence, even an unaccepted offer of complete relief can moot a case. He also cites precedent that seeking attorney's fees and court costs are not enough to stave off mootness. Justice Alito's separate dissent puts the plaintiff agreement point pithily. For mootness purposes, he says, there is nothing talismanic about the plaintiff's acceptance. A plaintiff cannot thwart mootness by refusing complete relief presented on a silver platter. Alito also suggests some specific ways that a defendant could moot a case other than handing over cash. For example, he could hand the plaintiff a certified check, deposit the funds in a bank account in the plaintiff's name, or deposit the money with the district court to be released when the court dismisses the case as moot. Justice Alito suggests the last of these options is preferable because it would enable the defendant to reclaim the money in the event a court determines that the offer is not for full relief or otherwise refuses to dismiss the case. Let me end with a few comments on noteworthy aspects of the decision. First, most observers are calling this a 6-3 decision, but I don't really think that's accurate. I think it's a 5-1-3 decision because even though Justice Thomas concurs in the judgment, his rationale would not extend as easily to future cases. That is, it appears more likely that his vote could swing in the event that a defendant had actually paid a plaintiff. Second, the Supreme Court affirmed a Ninth Circuit decision here, which is not that common, so I think it's worth noting. Third, the majority here adopted the reasoning of Justice Kagan's dissent in Genesis Healthcare Corp. v. Simchick, and although that case was not overruled, that fact that they adopted her dissent may cause some lower courts to follow that case less fastidiously going forward. Another point is that several justices raised the question at oral argument of whether Gomez could ever be considered an adequate class representative when he had turned down the request of relief in this case, something that most class members presumably would not do. Chief Justice Roberts, for example, asked whether Gomez would be an adequate class representative under these facts. Analogously, I think it's a fair question whether the requested judicial relief would likely redress the injury. When the plaintiff turns down an offer of settlement for complete relief, it calls into question whether the relief sought was really likely to redress the injury after all. The next point worth noting is that Justice Breyer mentioned the AFL-CIO's amicus brief filed on Gomez's side and asked whether Gomez agreed with it. His counsel said no at oral argument, which is unusual for someone talking about an amicus brief on their side of the case. That brief suggested that an offer of settlement is not enough, but that actually tendering the money to the court is enough. Justice Breyer said he's being practical. He seems to be looking for a way to allow defendants to end cases by paying off plaintiffs, at least under some circumstances. So he might be a fifth vote in a future case. He did not show his cards in the opinions here. He just silently joined the majority. Justice Alito also cited the AFL-CIO brief in his dissent. So that brief definitely bears reading when briefs are prepared in the next case like this that makes it up to the court. Although Justice Scalia wrote a law review article on the topic of standing as an essential element of the separation of powers back in 1983 before he joined the Supreme Court, he did not write separately here. However, it's worth noting that his passing makes the answer on the reserved question in this case effectively 5-3 unless Breyer shifts. The silver lining here is that there may, emphasize may, be five votes to find that a defendant can moot a plaintiff's case if it actually pays money into the court. It appears that of the remaining justices from this decision, the Chief Justice, Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, and possibly Justice Breyer would accept this outcome. However, those four need to find a fifth vote, and that becomes harder unless Justice Scalia is replaced by a like-minded jurist. Perhaps I should conclude by noting that my post-oral argument predictions about how this case would turn out did not pan out, so you may want to take my predictions with a grain of salt as to how the issues this case left open will play out.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.